towards the end, I'd like you to have at least one seat between you and the next person. So if you have more than one seat, move over. If you have less than one seat, move forward. Okay? At least one seat between you and the next person. So especially those people towards the back. Move forward. There's plenty of room up front. I'm not even paying attention to you guys. So. Okay, everybody settled in? If you're sitting next to somebody, I want you moving up front. Come on. I see at least a couple of people sitting together. Come on. There's plenty of room up front. Right there. Front row. It's an exam. I can't call on you in the middle of an exam. You can go back to the back at the end if you want. Okay? Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pass the exams out face down. Do not turn the exams over till I say yes. Turn the exams over. So when you get the exams, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write your name on the back of the exam, your own name. Okay? Don't sign it. I don't want your autograph. I want a name I can read. Okay, so back on the back of the exam. You'll see later why I need it on the back of the exam. Everybody get the rules? So I'm going to pass the exam out. Do not turn the exam over till everybody has a copy. Then we'll all turn it over at the same time so you don't get that 5-minute advantage. Take one, pass it back. Don't turn it over. Take one, pass it back. I'm going to start off here. Go right there. Okay, folks, please, no more chatting. We're in exam time. Yeah, you can write it. Calculators are allowed, yeah. There's one coming back there. Take it. Yeah. Write your name on the back when you get a chance. There comes some coming back there. If you get to the end of the row, just pass it on to the next section. Don't turn your exams over. I'm almost with you. Exam. Don't worry. Nobody's turned it over yet, so you don't have a disadvantage right now. You got the exam already? Everybody's got an exam? Okay, does everybody have an exam? Do you need one? One. Got behind you, too. Okay, write your name in the back. You can turn it over. You have 30 minutes starting now. So the exam ends at 4:04 based on that clock. You have 15 minutes left. attention for just a moment, please. If you don't know what market cap is the market value of equity. So in case you didn't know. So if you have no idea what I'm talking about, just ignore what I said. It's left. They're always levered beta, so. But that beta won't work anymore. Where the money came from. No, assuming you take on the debt.
About this reason. You say more risky. Are you trying to say the same thing as
no, it's exact.
As risky?
More risky. So as risky. If you, it's relative ratio.
Because in math, if you say more
okay.
Risky.
It's 1.5 times as risky.
Why is it even lower than the risk-free rate? Does it make sense?
Different currency. Sorry. Sorry to do this to you again. In case you don't know what assumed debt means, it means you take whatever debt a company has and you carry the debt. It becomes your debt. That's what assumed debt means. Okay.
time is up. Stop writing 300 quizzes in towards the end of each show. Either end, okay. Either end.
There any more quizzes? Time is up. That's it, I think. Okay, so okay, folks, get settled in. Okay, so three things. Three things about the quiz. Okay, stop turning to the person next to you and asking what the answer is because it's not going to match. So the first thing about the quiz is, should Google buy Tesla? You say, I got Netflix. There are two different quizzes in case you didn't know. Okay? And no two of you sitting next to each other had the same quiz. So if I get the perfect solution to the wrong quiz, you are completely and totally sunk. There is no way you can explain that away. It's happened twice in this class. Okay? And the first time it happened, the person said, that was very tricky of you. I said, what? You had an exam in front of you. Do the damn exam. What does it matter that the next person has a different exam? They were exactly the same degree of difficulty. Because all I did was, I changed the numbers, and I changed the company, and I changed the currency, and I left the problems untouched. So two different quizzes. Here's what's going to happen. Right now, the TAs are sorting the quizzes alphabetically. So when I get back to my office at 4:45, they'll be physically sorted from A through Z for me. And when I start on my journey home on the train, I'll start grading. And I'll keep grading, and I'll keep grading, till I stop grading again. And when I'm done grading, I will send you an email saying, so all the grades, so if you have a problem with the quiz, it's all my fault. The TAs have nothing to do with the grading. I will grade it. I grade fast, and I grade sloppy. Which means that when you get your quiz back, if you don't like something, don't bitch and moan about it. Don't stew in your own juices. Come in and tell me, I think this is wrong. I think I should have got credit. We'll talk about it. Maybe I did mess up. Okay? So when the quiz is ready, here's what you get. You get an email with the solutions to the quizzes. Two quizzes, both quizzes. And I'll tell you which quiz was yours. I'll call the first quiz the Tesla quiz and the second quiz the Netflix quiz. So when you pick your quiz up, you compare your answers to the quiz. There'll be a grading template to the side that'll tell you how I took points off and why I took points off. Check your answers. Okay? So you will get the solutions. And the reason I said to write your name on the back is here's how you pick up the quizzes. I'm probably violating every NYU rule on the book. I don't care. The quizzes will be face down on the ninth floor. So I'll tell you where to go. They'll be face down in alphabetical order. Face down. So you know your name. You know where your last name goes in the alphabet. Don't browse. This isn't Barnes & Noble. Don't sit there. Let me look at other people's quizzes. Pick your quiz up. Check it out. And if you have a problem, bring it back to me. Okay? So I will let you know when it's ready to pick up. It'll be sooner than you think. Okay? So let's, I know you're in no mood for any kind of intense stuff. So today we're going to do the easy stuff. We got into the cost of equity. That was the complex stuff, equity risk premiums and betas and risk-free rates. Today I want to talk about the other way you can raise money. Remember, there are two ways of raising money. The first, of course, is equity, and everything we've done so far is to attach a cost to that equity. Today I want to talk about the cost of debt. And here's the way I'm going to set up the discussion. I'm going to start off by first telling you what I think of as debt. What's debt? That's easy. Just look at the balance sheet. It's not that simple. So we're going to talk about what it is that makes debt debt. Second, we're going to attach a cost to that debt. So when I say, how much does it cost you to borrow money, you have to give me a rate, 6%, 8%, 5%, 13%, whatever it is. So we'll attach a cost. And third, we'll bring it to fruition by saying, how do we come up with the weights for debt and equity? So let's get the process rolling by first looking at what it is that makes debt debt. Here are the three criteria that you look for to classify something as debt. Ready? First, debt gives rise to a contractual commitment. What does that mean? You agree to pay something contractually. With equity, remember, there is no contractual commitment. You might say, I'm issuing shares, I might pay a dividend, but if I don't pay a dividend, you can't sue me. There's no contractual commitment to equity. With debt, there's a contractual commitment. Second, that contractual payment you have to make every year is tax deductible in most countries. Most countries. Parts of the Middle East, it's not. In most countries, that contractual payment is tax deductible. So there's a contractual payment. It's tax deductible. And if you fail to make that payment, bad things happen to you. Like what? Your knees might get broken if it's a money lender, or if it's a corporation, you go bankrupt. You ready? Contractual payment, tax deductible, loss of control. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start listing items that I see on a balance sheet, and you tell me whether they pass the criteria to be called debt. Let's start easy. Corporate bonds. Obviously, right? There's a coupon payment. It's contractually required, tax deductible, loss. If you fail to make it, you go bankrupt. Corporate bonds are obviously debt. How about a long-term bank loan? Absolutely. How about a short-term bank loan? Sure. In fact, the reason I separated the two is I'm amazed at how many investment banks, when you ask them what the debt ratio for a company is, count only long-term debt. What are you trying to tell me? If I take on six-month loans, I don't have to pay them back? All interest-bearing debt is clearly meeting the criteria for debt. Now let's get to the tricky items, and you tell me whether you treat these as debt. In most companies' balance sheets, you have accounts payable and supplier credit. It's on the liability side of the balance sheet, right? You owe that money. Should I count that as debt? And if not, why not? Accounts payable, it's huge for some companies. It could be tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. Should I count accounts payable as debt? Yes. It is actually tax deductible. The way it shows up is when you have accounts payable, when you pay the amount, it shows up in your cost of goods sold. There's a delayed tax effect. Okay, so it does have the tax deduction. It is. What's missing is there is no interest payment, no explicit interest payment. See why I said explicit? How does accounts payable or supplier credit work? You buy something from a supplier. He says you can pay right away, you can wait 60 days. He's not stupid. To get you to pay right away, what does he offer you usually? He offers you a discount. So by taking on the supplier credit, what you've lost is a discount. That's like the interest rate on the debt. If you're willing to separate that discount and treat it as interest expenses, you can treat supplier credit as debt. The only problem is doing that for a real company is a nightmare. So supplier credit and accounts payable, I'm not going to count as debt. Not because I don't owe the money, but because it doesn't have that explicit interest payment. Increasingly, balance sheets also have these accounting items. Like what? Underfunded pension obligations you're required to show on your balance sheet now. These are obligations you have as a company that you have to set money aside for. You haven't set aside enough money. It shows up as a liability. However, in the U.S., it has no teeth. So after you show it, you're not required to make up for it with contractual payments. So I'm not going to count it as debt. That's on the balance sheet. Now, here's where it gets messy. There are things I do as a company that meet all the criteria but don't show up on the balance sheet. Let me give you an example. If you're Walmart and you want to open a new store, you don't buy the land and build the store, you lease the store. And usually the lease is an operating lease. What does that mean? You sign a 12-year lease with the landlord and say, for the next 12 years, I will pay $5 million a year. Let's go through the list. Is that a contractual payment? It's a contract, $5 million a year. You can't go to the landowner and say, look, you know, nobody showed up in my store last year. Can I pay you nothing? Fixed payment. It is tax deductible because it shows up as an expense when I do my taxes. And if you fail to make a lease payment, what happens? The landowner can take the store back from you. And if you fail on a bunch of leases at the same time, you're going to go bankrupt. That's how Bradley and Keldors, two discount retailers in the U.S., went bankrupt, is they failed on a bunch of lease payments at the same time. Now, accountants have this strange classification of leases into operating and capital leases. Operating leases don't show up as debt. Capital leases do. It is a stupid categorization. It makes no sense. They've known it for 60 years. How do I know? There's actually a panel in 1949 that got together in accounting and said, we should be treating leases as debt, 1949. Finally, they think it's in 2019 that they finally make that adjustment. You can't wait for accountants to do the right thing. Just treat lease commitments as debt and move on. So any interest-bearing debt, any lease payment, whether it's operating or capital, I'm going to treat as debt. So that's the first piece. That's what I'm going to call debt. Now let's talk about the cost of debt. The cost of debt is the rate at which I, as a business, can borrow money long-term today. Two key words there. It's the rate at which I can borrow money long-term. You know why I put that in? Because if I let you tell me what your cost of debt is based on the rate at which you borrow money, given that short-term borrowing is cheaper than long-term borrowing, you're going to say, I'm going to take on six-month loans. Look, my cost of debt went down. I'm saying, no. If you borrow money, I'm going to act like you borrow money long-term, even if you choose to borrow the money short-term. So it's long-term. And it's the rate at which you can borrow money today. Why is that significant? Because otherwise, you're going to show me that bank loan you took 2 years ago. Look, I got that really cheap bank loan. I don't care. It's a rate at which you can borrow money today. And that's going to make our job incredibly simple. Here's why. If you're a U.S. company borrowing money in U.S. dollars today, what's the minimum long-term cost of debt you should have today? Let's define long-term as 10 years. What's the minimum number you should have? What rate? It should be the T-bond rate, which we that same risk-free rate we used in the cost of equity will now become the base from which I'm going to build off the cost of debt. So right now, the T-bond rate is 1.75%, so that's where I'm going to start. But I'm not going to stop there. Why? Because you're not the government. You don't have a printing press in the basement. When you borrow money, you got to pay what's called a credit spread or a default spread on top of that 1.75%. And how big it is will depend on how much risk I see in you as a company. So if you're, I don't know, Apple, and you borrow money, I'm not lying awake at night saying, will you pay me back? Will you not pay me back? You got $225 billion in cash to pay me. I'm saying this, I'm going to get paid. My spread, the default spread might be 0.5% or 0.3%. But if I'm lending money to, I don't know, GoPro, I'm not sure I'll ever get paid back. So I might charge a 10% spread on top of the 1.75%. The entire game of estimating cost of debt therefore boils down to how much of a default spread should I be charging for this company? It's a lot simpler than cost of equity. Because if you get that default spread, you effectively got the cost of debt. So I'm going to estimate the cost of debt for three of my companies where I took the easy way out. And I'll explain what I mean by the easy way out. Where I let somebody else estimate the default risk in the company. And then I'm going to talk about what to do when you don't have that easy option. So let's start with the easy companies. For three of my companies, Disney, Deutsche Bank, and Vale, I let somebody else assess credit risk in these companies. What do I mean by this? These three companies have ratings from S&P and Moody's. Remember, S&P and Moody's rated countries, they also rate companies. And these are the ratings that they gave Disney, Deutsche, and Vale. Disney and Deutsche were rated single A. Vale was rated A minus. Now, when I do this, of course, I'm trusting the ratings agencies to know what they're doing, which is a dangerous assumption, but it does save me a lot of time. So I'm going to say, if the ratings agency tells me that Disney and Deutsche are single A, I'm going to believe them, that that measures the default risk in the company. Vale had an A minus rating. Now, how does a rating help me? If I know what your rating is as a company, I can try to estimate the default spread that goes with that rating. Remember how we did this with sovereign ratings, right? You told me the rating, I got a default spread. I'm going to do exactly the same thing. I have a lookup table for just companies. You tell me your rating as a company and say, hey, you're triple B rated, your default spread should be 2.25%. You're single A rated, it should be 1.5%. You're triple A rated, it should be 0.6%. And I'm going to add that on to my risk-free rate, and I'm done. So in this case, here's all I did. I took the default spreads, which for single A rated companies was 1%, and A-minus rated companies was 1.3%. I added that on to whatever risk-free rate I'm doing my analysis in, which is US dollars for Disney and Vale, and euros for Deutsche Bank. I got a cost of debt for each of these three companies. Now, incidentally, for Vale, remember I gave you that little trick to convert a dollar number into a real number? You can use the same trick for the cost of debt. If you say, what if Vale borrows nominal reais? You take the 4.05% that you got as your dollar cost of debt. Remember the 9% and 2% inflation that we use for Brazil and the U.S.? Use exactly the same process we used to adjust the cost of equity, and we got a cost of debt in dollar terms for Vale. So just like the cost of equity, you can move the cost of debt in different currencies based on that inflation. So if you have an actual rating for a company, you're home free. About two-thirds of you, if you pick companies, will probably find a rating for your company. You say, how will I find it? Just go into Google search and say, company bond rating. If there's a rating, it'll pop up, Moody's, S&P. But for a third of you, this approach, you're going to get an answer from Google saying, we could not find a rating. So you're saying, what do I do now? So I'll give you my second choice. If I cannot find a rating, or even sometimes when I do find a rating, I try to estimate a rating for the company. I try to act like a ratings agency. And luckily, ratings agencies are the most transparent organizations in the world. Here's why. What's the output from a ratings agency? What does S&P and Moody tell us about companies? They give us the ratings for every company they rate, right? AAA down the way, all the way down to C. Then they give away the game. You go to the S&P website, they give you the 8 ratios they use to come up with those ratings. So they say, this is the rating, these are the 8 ratios. We have a magic formula we use. We can't tell you what the magic formula is, but we use these 8 ratios to come up with the rating. I don't need to know what the magic formula is, right? In fact, the first time I tried to act like a ratings agency, here's what I did. I downloaded the rating for every rated company. At that time, it was mostly in the U.S. I had 1,500 companies with ratings. I downloaded all 8 ratios that they said they used. I had this big Excel spreadsheet, rating in the first column, 8 ratios in the next 8. And then I did some reverse engineering. You know what I mean by reverse engineering? I sorted based on ratings. Say, can I try to figure out what they're doing by looking at the output? And guess what? It was pretty easy. It turned out that one of those 8 ratios did the bulk of the lifting. It's a ratio called the interest coverage ratio. It's earnings before interest and taxes, which is the operating income of a company, divided by the interest expense. It's a very simple ratio. You see, what about the other 7 ratios? The interest coverage ratio alone explained half of the differences in ratings across all companies. The other 7 ratios put together explained another 15%. So if I want to build a perfect rating, I'd use all 8 ratios. I don't want a perfect rating. I just want to be within shouting distance of the true rating. I'm going to base it on one ratio, the interest coverage ratio. So here's what it looks like for my 5 companies. for Disney, Vale, Tata Motors, Baidu, and Bookscape, I took the operating income that comes right from the income statement. I divided by the interest expense. And in the last column, you see my interest coverage ratio. Now, let me ask you a question. It's an intuitive question. If you're lending to a company, do you want that number to be a really high number or a really low number? You want it to be a really high number. Why? Because then you have a much bigger buffer, right? Bad things can happen. You're still going to get paid. The higher that number, the safer you are as a company. So if you look at that interest coverage ratio, you want that number to be as high as possible because it means your company is safer. But I have a tougher task. I have to take that interest coverage ratio in the last column and convert it into a rating. Remember I said I have a lookup table? I have a lookup table where if you give me the interest coverage ratio for your company, I'll guess your rating. Here's what the table looked like in 2013. So basically, you see two columns. First is if you're a large market cap company. The second is if you're a small market cap company. Why two set of rules? Because life's not fair. If you're a large company, you get a higher rating for the same interest coverage ratio than if you're a small company. So let's start with Disney. Large year means a market capitalization greater than $5 billion. Disney is a $130 billion company. So it's a large company. Its interest coverage ratio is 22.57. So if you go and look at 22.57, it's off the chart. It's higher than 8.5, obviously. And based on that 22.57, the rating I would give Disney is AAA. I'm going to call this a synthetic rating because, in a sense, I've made it up. It's not an actual rating from the ratings agency. It's my attempt to rate the company. So for Disney, I get a AAA rating. Then I move to Vale. It's a large cap company, but it's an emerging market company. And for emerging market companies, I use the small cap because emerging market companies, again, it's not fair, get judged against a tougher standard. Vale's interest coverage ratio was 11.67 when I did this. 11.67 puts me right there, 9.5 to 12.5. And if you look across, that's a AA rating. Tata Motors, large cap, emerging market, 4.51. They barely make the cut, but they have an A-minus rating. Baidu, small cap, really, really small company. It's a private business. Small cap. It's not that tiny, but it's small cap. Emerging market company, 23.72. And I give it a AAA rating. Part of you saying, there's no way Baidu could ever get a AAA rating. You're absolutely right. But you're going to see in a minute why I don't want to use too much energy trying to get the rating for Baidu. And finally, I look at Bookscape, private business, 5.16 interest coverage ratio. Oh, there you go, A-. So I have a synthetic rating for each of the five companies. Yes? Developing any emerging market company, even if it's large cap, I put into the risk into that second column. That's why developing an emerging matters. So if you're an emerging market company, you never even get into the large cap column because you're viewed as riskier and you're given the lower rating. Right? Incidentally, you know what Vale's interest coverage ratio is right now? It was 11.67 in 2013. Right now, it's 2.2. What happened? Iron ore prices were $80 in 2013. They're now $25. Its operating income has collapsed. The interest coverage ratio is 2.2. At 2.2, they're actually a single B-rated company. They're on the verge of disaster. So things can change. So you can't just do this and forget about it. You've got to revisit your company. It lets you kind of assess the default risk in the company. Yes?
Does it matter where the operation of the company is?
Not yet. We'll talk about why it might matter when you do the cost of debt. But for the moment, just take the rating, get the default spread. We'll talk about how where you're doing business can affect your cost of debt. Right? Yes? The spreads actually come from looking at publicly traded bonds in each ratings class. It's actually public. You can look it up on Bloomberg. You can look it up. In fact, I'll send you a couple of links online where you can look up what these spreads look like. They're updated on a daily basis in the Federal Reserve website in St. Louis. They have a data place, and you can go check it out. So any other questions? Now, for three of these companies, I had an actual rating, right? Now I have a synthetic rating. I was just curious, how close to the actual rating did I get? Because after all, I'm making up all this stuff. The ratings agency, that's a big building S&P owns downtown. They must do something there. So here's what I did. I took the three companies for which I had actual ratings and compared it to my synthetic ratings. Do you remember what Disney's actual rating was? It was single A. What's the rating I'm giving Disney? I'm giving it AAA. So I said, what's going on here? And there's a very simple reason why my rating is different. Disney had a really good year in 2013. Do you see why that matters? My interest coverage ratio was calculated based on the most recent year. And if you're a ratings agency and you have any sense, you shouldn't be basing your rating on how good last year was, but on how good the company is across time. That's an easy fix for that. If I wanted to, I could compute an interest coverage ratio average across 5 or 10 years. I was too lazy to do that, but I knew why my rating was different. I just used a really good year. With Vale, my rating was AA, and the actual rating was A-. And here there's a very good reason. Vale is a Brazilian company. They're saying, so what? For a long time, the ratings agencies used to have what was called a sovereign rating ceiling. Have you heard about this? No company in a country was ever allowed to have a rating higher than the country. Can you imagine being a Venezuelan company? Or an Argentine company? Or a Greek company? It's not fair, right? But life's not fair. You're a Greek company, you go into bank and say, I want to borrow money. What does the bank say? 25% plus. So I haven't shown you any of my financials. Doesn't matter. You're a Greek company. So whether you like it or not, ratings agencies attach ratings. So the A- reflects the fact that Vale is a Brazilian company and the ratings agency brings in country risk. It doesn't have a rating ceiling anymore, but it does bring in country risk into the rating. Deutsche had an A rating. Notice I didn't do a synthetic rating. Why didn't I do it? I have to compute an interest coverage ratio. I don't want to go into that hellhole with a bank, because who knows what the interest expense on a bank is. It could include interest paid on deposits. So Deutsche, I just said, the rating agency is right. I know they're right. I have no way of checking, so I'm going to take that rating as given. So for the three companies that have ratings, I have a way of explaining the ratings. Now let's take this rating and convert it into a cost of debt. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the risk-free rate, and I'm going to add a default spread, right? So let's start simple. Let's start with Bookscape, where the only rating I have is a synthetic rating. There's no Moody's and S&P are never going to rate an independent bookstore in New York City. Based on the synthetic rating, the cost of debt I have before taxes is the risk-free rate plus that default spread, 2.75 plus 1.3, 4.05%. That's my cost of borrowing money. But wait, when you borrow money and you make interest expenses, what does the government allow you to do? It allows you to deduct those interest expenses for taxes. You're going to save taxes. How much? Interest saves you money at the margin. Let me explain what I mean by that. How many of you do your own taxes? You say, I have no income. Why should I do taxes? Hey, you do your own taxes? What do you use? TurboTax? Okay. So you use some kind of online tax program, right? So let's create a hypothetical. Let's suppose you have $1 million in income. If I'm insulting you, add a zero. Okay. You have $1 million in income, and you have $100,000 in interest expenses. You know what you have to report as taxable income to the U.S. government? You take the million, you subtract out the $100,000, you report $900,000 as taxable income. You think, where's the story going? Think of where you saved on taxes. You saved on the last $100,000 of income, not on the first, not in the middle, but the last 100,000. The marginal tax rate is the tax rate on your last dollar of income. And if you are living and working in New York City, I strongly suggest you never compute your marginal tax rate. It'll depress you incredibly. At the end of my TurboTax, when I finish my tax, it computes an average tax rate, an effective tax rate. It said this year, for some reason, it congratulates you for finishing your taxes. Congratulations, you finished your tax return. This year, you pay 28.66% of your income in taxes. It basically takes the taxes paid divided by taxable income. But that's not your marginal tax rate. That's your average tax rate across all your income. You're saying, what's your marginal tax rate? You want to get depressed? Let's try this for New York City. Let's say you graduate, you go to work in New York City, you make, let's say, $150,000 starting. You're just brilliant. You start off at 150. Let's work out what your marginal tax rate is going to be. What's a federal marginal tax rate on $150,000 in income? Right now, it's 36%. So that's the first chunk out, right? You think, God, that's a lot of money leaving. Well, I'm not done with you. That's just the federal slice. What, you know what the New York state tax is on $150,000 income at the margin? It's 8.5%. So they take their 8.5%. But I'm not done with you yet. You live in New York City, that's another 3%. Soon it's only a matter of time before Chelsea says, you know what, you live in Chelsea, give me 2%. And the guy outside your building says, you live in this building, give me 1%. They're like a line of people with clubs lined up to take your money from you as you come out. That's why when you see your first paycheck, you're going to be shocked at how little money. Because when you go to your job, they said 65,000. You divide that by 12, you're sitting there, I'm going to make 5,000 something every month. Look at a paycheck, $3,150. What the hell happened? Taxes, that's what happened. That's your marginal tax rate. In the New York City area, if you work, your marginal tax rate, even if you make 150, is 45. If you make a million, it's like 51%. So let's round it up to a nice 50%. You go out and borrow money to buy an apartment. This is after you make the 150. So don't jump the gun and go buy the apartment. Now, where's the money coming from? It's after you make the money, you buy an apartment. You borrow money at 5%. Effectively, what do you pay? You pay 5%, you get a 50% tax savings from that interest expense. You're effectively paying only 2.5%. So my cost of debt for Bookscape is the rate at which I can borrow it, 4.05%, net of the marginal tax rate, which in the case of Bookscape is 40%, because it's a private business that's incorporated in New York State. It's about a 40% tax rate. My after-tax cost of debt is 2.43%. So that's my after-tax cost of borrowing for Bookscape. For Disney, Deutsche, and Vale, remember I said I was going to use the actual rating. Based on the rating, I have my cost of debt. Those are the marginal tax rates for the three companies. For Disney, the marginal tax rate was 36.1%. The reason I was able to get so specific with it is Disney in its financial statements actually has a footnote where they tell you what their marginal tax rates are. Federal, state, local, and they add them all up and say, last year, our marginal tax rate was 36.1. If you cannot find that in your financial statements, just use the marginal tax rate of whichever country your company is in. Okay? And if you go to my website, I actually have marginal tax rates by country for 135 countries. I would love to say that I came up with these numbers, but I just stole them from KPMG. Every year they update these numbers so you can see what the tax rates look like. So there's my after-tax cost of debt for Disney, Deutsche, and Vale. For Tata Motors, there was a rating. But the rating wasn't from S&P or Moody's. It was from an Indian ratings agency that rates Tata Motors against other Indian companies. You're going to see in a minute why this is going to be an issue. So when Crisil, which is the Indian ratings agency, gives you a AAA as an Indian company, they're saying relative to other Indian companies, you look really safe. So here's what I had to do to estimate the cost of debt for Tata Motors. I started with the risk-free rate in Indian rupees. Remember how I got that government bond rate minus default spread for India? 6.57%. But I can't stop there. I added the default spread for Tata Motors based on its rating, 0.7%. But I also added the default spread of India as a country. Why? Because life's not fair. You're a Greek company when you go to borrow money. When people lend to you, they're going to charge you not just what your default spread is as a company. You carry two default spreads on your shoulder. One is your country, one is your company. My cost of debt is 9.62%. The marginal tax rate in India was 32.45%. Repeat terms, after-tax cost of debt is 6.5%. Justin?
Aren't you just subtracting the default spread for India to
get the rate? Yeah, adding it back. She's saying, why go through it? Because you might not have to. So if I were Disney investing in India, in rupees, I'm allowed to do that, right? Let's say I start a theme park in India. I decide to make the investment in rupees. And I go to borrow money from an Indian bank. I don't have to pay the Indian country default spread. So it's a built-in advantage that developed market companies will have when they compete against emerging market companies. So you have to preserve that option because it's not automatic that any time you do a cost of debt in rupees, you're going to add the default spread for India. It's because this is an Indian company. And you know what? Tata Motors might have an escape hatch. Who did they buy in 2009? Remind me again. They bought Jaguar Land Rover. And when Jaguar Land Rover walks into a bank, I'm not sure the bank even knows that they're part of Tata Motors. So it's entirely possible that, at least in the case of Tata Motors, there's a way in which they can borrow money and not get the default spread for India added to them, which they're probably using, which is why so much of their bond issue is coming from outside India. So those are the default spreads as of January 2016. I don't know what happened to this page, but actually the default spreads are on page 182. So if there's a blank page, that was just to throw you off. Okay? So these are the updated numbers, January 2016. This is what I pulled off. And you can get the February and the March if you want to. You can get the updated numbers. Yeah.
Default spread of the company?
Yeah. That it comes from the lookup table. So basically, if you look at this lookup table, if you go with the rating, so it's the default spread going with that rating. Okay. Right? So in the case of Tata Motors, the 0.7% is the AA rating spread. Okay. So it just comes from that table. Yes?
For the cost of debt, so another way you can solve it is to just like get the 10-year bond from that country and then just add the default spread of the company. Right?
Yeah, you could do that. It'll give you the same thing in that currency, absolutely. Oh, one point. This is from last year. I show you the spreads from the start of the year and the end of the year. So the yellow was at the start of 2015. The blue was at the end of 2015. Notice something across the board what happened last year. The default spreads all went up dramatically. Why did it happen? This is an ongoing story. Across markets, you're seeing this rise in the price of risk. It's what's scaring people. It's what's making bank stocks go down. Default risk is increasing, partly because of the commodity price problem we have. As commodity prices drop, a lot of oil companies are potentially on the verge of defaulting. That's pushing up default spreads. You're seeing it kind of affect other companies. Question?
So on the previous slide.
Yeah, this blank slide? Or the slide before that?
Yes, the one before that.
Okay.
So you're not putting that's like a theoretical cost of debt.
When you say theoretical, what does it mean? Yeah, give me. Yeah.
So why not just take that mark-to-market interest rate?
When you say mark-to-market interest rate, what does that entail?
Whatever it's trading at.
So you have debt that's traded. So you have a bond, right? So the bond is traded, you get a yield to maturity in the bond. What do you think goes into yield to maturity in a bond? There's a risk-free rate. There's a default spread. You're saying, why shouldn't I just look up the default spread in a bond that's traded? 1% of all companies globally have a traded bond, you can do this. If you can find a traded bond, make sure first it's cleaned up. You can't use a convertible bond. You can't use a bond with special features. If you get a clean bond, it's traded, you're done. You don't even need a rating. You can just look up the yield to maturity on the bond, and that'll give you this cost of debt. But that's going to work in about 1% of all cases. Because most companies don't issue bonds. 70% of the companies around the world borrow how? What's the preferred way of borrowing? They go to a bank, bank loans. Across the world, most companies, among the 30% that issue bonds, most companies' bonds never get traded. They get issued, they go into somebody's portfolio. So about 2 to 3% of all corporations that issue bonds, those are the bonds that you'll see traded. That's why if you look at going to the corporate bond market, it's a very small segment that you'll see a lot of trading on. The rest is all matrix pricing, which means you're just guessing on what the price is because there's no trading. So that's why it's so difficult using that approach. Otherwise, I'd go there. It's the easiest way to get to the cost of debt. Okay? Yes?
So, we have a higher marginal tax rate.
Borrowing money. The question was, if you have a higher marginal tax rate, should you borrow money? This is the answer to the question. Why do the people who need the money the least borrow the most? There's your answer. If you have a 90% tax rate, borrow like crazy. You don't need the money. Just keep borrowing. Lend it to other people if you want. Okay? In fact, that's the basis for the leasing business. Right? People at high tax rates would borrow money, buy assets, lease it out to you, because then you got the advantage of the 90% tax rate and took a little bit of the benefit that the 40% tax rate guy got. So that's exactly why people borrow when they don't need the money. That's why you'll have people with $5 million in the bank who'll go and borrow $2 million to buy a house. So that's crazy. It's crazy until you think about the tax effects we built it. Yes?
What's the fundamentals underlying, say, a spread?
It's very simple. The chance you will not pay me back. It's as simple as that. If I'm a bank, what do I have to worry about? That you won't pay me back. That's what's built into the default spread. It's the chance you won't pay me back, and that chance is embedded in that spread. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I will see you on
Okay, I'll give you an example.